This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And you research your investments, you analyze markets, you even manage risk. But have you researched your broker? For the past 3 years, Interactive Brokers' individual clients averaged an annual return of 24.3%, compared to 23.1% on the S&P 500. IBKR's lower trading cost, competitive rates, efficient execution, and access to over 170 global markets help investors keep more of what they earn and put more capital to work. Over time, the broker you choose matters. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. If you care about performance, find out why the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers at ibkr.com/performance. That's ibkr.com/performance.
The disciplined investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The war is on. The war is off. I can't keep track anymore. But one thing we know is that the oil is not flowing through the strait. Well, we're going to be looking at that and what the story the market's trying to tell us. Our guest today is entrepreneur and angel investor Howard Lindzen, CEO and founder of Social Capital. All this and much more on episode number 970 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. From the windy downtown Fort Lauderdale offices in the studio, Andrew Horowitz with you for another great episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Great show lined up this week. So I think we got to start talking about what's going on with the markets. I mean, to begin with, we know there's problems. We know the fact is that markets are doing pretty good, right? But there's a lot of weird stuff going on under the surface. We are reacting to almost every single news item that comes up, the stream of consciousness from the media that is coming and hitting our mailboxes and hitting our inboxes and hitting the TVs and our emails and our radios and whatever else is going on, social media streams, is quite unbelievable. And the issue that really I think we need to focus in on is what's going on in the markets this week. Because on the surface, again, things look pretty calm. Almost too calm is what I'm going to tell you right now. But stocks are hitting all-time highs. The S&P and the NASDAQ are pushing records again. Earnings season is off to a great start. And if you just took a look and stopped and looked at your account balance, you might think everything is just smooth, cruising along like it's just fantastic. But underneath the surface, the market is sending some very mixed signals. And I think that's something that we should really focus in on. Here's the interesting part, right? Stocks are acting like the world is fine. We know that is not the case. We know that there are some issues that are going on with regard to the war on off, oil being compressed, urea issues and agricultural prices, inflation. There's a whole host of things that are really problematic. But at the same time there are parts of the market that are doing just fine, there are other parts of the market that, in fact, are actually not so convinced. Equities are basically saying to us right now that, you know, we're good. Earnings season is here. Earnings matter again. About 80% of the stocks that have reported have beat earnings already. Geopolitics, they're manageable. Let's just keep moving along. Don't worry about it. Keep your head down. Just move along. Look at what's going on. And let's just kind of just see what happens here. At the same time, though, bonds are saying, you know what? Hang on for a second. There are some issues maybe that you're not realizing. And one of the things that we know and that we've seen for many years is that there has been a commentary, there's an undercurrent, there's a discussion that says, you know, bond investors and the bond market is a lot smarter than the equity market in the long run. Not in the day and the week, but in the long run, the bond market wins out. Long-term interest rates are still elevated. We know that. And volatility has been creeping higher, even when stock prices are on the rise. Oil, once again, causing people to quietly do the math, look at inflation, and wonder, how long is this going to be okay? Inflation is stickier than most have hoped it to be. And that combination doesn't usually last very long. This optimism in equity markets, a bit more pessimism in the fixed income and bond markets, and then we know what's gone on with the volatility VIX ratio. One of the most telling things probably in the market right now, and this week in particular, is that stock and bonds are having two different conversations like we're talking about. Stocks very optimistic, bonds very skeptical. And when that happens, something has to give. Now, oil is still another wild card that we have to really focus in on. Energy prices have jumped on renewed Middle East uncertainty. Okay, that is an ongoing discussion. No news to anybody right there. But the fact that we have this ceasefire now, this prolonged time period where we're going to just put a halt to any kind of worry, supposedly, about going back to war and obliterating and killing an entire civilization. I guess that's somehow going to be something in the past. But the shrugging off of this is what really concerned me, because higher oil prices feeds into all sorts of other places, and the inflationary impact is being felt. And if oil stays elevated, that is going to be an issue that I am concerned about. Because when it does, it becomes much more difficult to handle the inflationary impact across all areas. The Fed has a much more difficult time. And the meaningfully cooling part of the energy story that we were all hoping for becomes very complicated. That aggressive rate cut's not going to happen unless we have such a impact from the oil prices that it throws us into a recession. That's even worse off. And again, yet stocks are choosing to ignore all of this for now. Why? Well, because the heavy lifting is being done by companies that have the biggest market capitalizations that are delivering profits. So that's good. With the makeup of the S&P 500, listen, last week on Wednesday was fascinating. We had a great run, continuation of the all-time highs in the NASDAQ and the S&P. But would you believe if I told you during that run, that particular day where we saw great numbers come out of Boeing, for example, and a few other companies, that the S&P equal weighted was actually down for the day, telling me and telling us very clearly that the breadth of the market was compressed into just those few stocks that were moving along and moving markets. So while they're delivering profits and still projecting margin gains that are going to be good, and still convincing investors that, you know, things are growing enough that we really don't have to worry too much about what's going on outside of the parameters of technology. And that's why this rally is really holding together, even with the higher rates. But here's a key point that doesn't get talked about enough, and that it's not a broad market right now. We're back to this very narrow, lack of breadth market that is only showing a few things that are really working. Leadership is narrow, mega cap technology doing great, AI names are resilient, a handful of consumer telecommunication names are doing pretty well as well. And smaller companies, rate sensitive sectors, equal weighted indices, sagging, or at least not doing as well comparatively on a relative basis. That's the important thing, the relative nature of this thing here. So that tells us something important, right? It's coincidence, and these conditions don't usually last long. So one of the quiet winners this year has been emerging markets, and that's important to understand. It's coming back. And when we look at that, when we look at emerging markets, historically, that's an important cue that risk on is there. So that's kind of great, right? It's not euphoria. It's not panic either. It's a market that feels a little less uneasy right now, going into an uncertain time. Not totally convinced, but yet not totally unconvinced either. And those kinds of markets can be tricky. Let's be honest. It can be a very tricky situation. So the takeaway right now, the takeaway right now is that the bull market isn't necessarily ending. And when we look at all this put together, we're in a phase where I think discipline continues to matter. The bad news is being priced out of the market. Maybe pullbacks will be continuing to be shallow and fast and bought. Volatility is staying inside the markets. That's just high enough to be a little bit annoying, to be honest with you, to kind of get you to wonder and to rethink things. And everything else kind of feels okay otherwise, because we're seeing these indices hit these all-time highs. So when we talk about some of the things like the rates and energy, and we talk about emerging markets, that's going to be the topic of next week's discussion, because next week we have someone who is been spent years talking about researching and looking at global markets, in particular emerging markets valuations, and especially emerging markets. That's Meb Faber from Cambria Investment. So we're going to have him on next week to see what he is feeling and what's signaling. So that's what it is. I think in summation, the markets are telling us, you know, I believe in earnings. It's here. It's good. That is the thing that we're going to focus on, at least right now. That's what we're going to focus on. And I'm not ready to be careless either. We're going to stick to what we know and what is working right now. And that's a message worth listening to. So I want you to think about that. And before we get to our guest this week, I want to talk about Interactive Brokers. Because you could trade your portfolio with the power of prediction market probabilities. With Interactive Brokers, trade prediction markets on election, climate, and economic outcomes right alongside stocks, options, and bonds. Prediction market prices reflect probability, and correct predictions receive $1 per contract. Plus, earn interest on your positions too. Prediction contracts are not suitable for all investors. Visit ibkr.com/predictions. Again, that's ibkr.com/predictions. So we're moving along. We're going to talk with our guest, Howard Lindzen. He's had a few decades of experience in both public and private market investing. He previously founded and managed the hedge fund Lindzen Capital and is currently the founder and general partner of the early stage venture capital firm Social Leverage, as well as the CEO at StockTwits, which is a leading platform for traders and investors. So through Social Leverage and his partnership, he has been able to seed investment startups like Robinhood and Manscaped and Beehive, amongst others. He's the founder of Wallstrip. I got to ask him about that today. And throughout his career, he's strongly advocated for and helped drive the decentralization and democratization of investing. So let's bring him right on. Howard Lindzen, you are here finally.
Good to see you. Even though you can't see me, good to see you.
It's great. I have a lot of questions to talk about. We're going to leave the whatever happened on the side for now. One day you'll do. I think you've explained it before, but I want to talk to you about some of the things that I didn't know about you that I dug up. It's okay. First of all, it's not the bad stuff because I but some of the things I didn't know about you. For example, back in the early 70s, way back, you were an entrepreneur. You were flipping unique products before kids even had like lemonade stands. So tell everybody about you and your family trips to New Mexico and the jewelry business that you started.
Well, I think it was, my dad was a bit of an entrepreneur. So he was a securities attorney, but you know, this is before the internet. So I think we're now getting back to this type of entrepreneurship with AI because, you know, AI's eating the internet, so marketing is becoming, you know, a little bit harder. But before the internet, you know, what entrepreneurship meant was finding a product and selling it to someone else for, well, I mean, that's still the business. You find a product that you think other people will like and bring that product to market or market out or find a customer that will pay a higher price for that product. So when we were kids and we would go to New Mexico, which my dad liked, we fell in love with like turquoise jewelry. You know, you go to these, I think it was a lot of Indian jewelry at the time in the 70s. And so we would buy, you know, hundreds of dollars worth of like what we had never seen in Toronto at the time, you know, rings, necklaces, et cetera. And then, you know, on the weekend have kind of these garage sales where we opened up, you know, our own little stand in our neighborhood. And it was a wealthier neighborhood, and we would just sell the jewelry at marked up prices, me and my sisters. So that was my first experience with having a store, I guess, illegally in my driveway, but with product that I bought in New Mexico, paid for by my family's trips, and then marked up to the neighborhood.
And this was like when you were around 10 or so?
Yeah, just about, you know, between 9 and 12 years right. old.
And then you were writing some big checks post your MBA to do a lot of things, and you were in Toronto. You were conservative back then. The question is, I guess, how is that experience that you had with the flipping jewelry kind of translates where what you're doing today?
Well, I think it taught me, again, back then the calculator, math. You know, I was just saw my friend called the human calculator. He's a friend of mine, Scott Flansburg, and we were just talking about how math has changed, right? Like, we're, you know, we went from doing math in your head and times tables to the calculator. And now kids will just go into ChatGPT, even though these things makes, you know, what do you call them? Hallucinations,
yeah, mistakes.
Around basic math. Right. Kids just all of a sudden trust a machine that isn't even a calculator to do the math for them. So I think what it taught me was how to mark things up, you know. We didn't know how professionally to mark things up, but like back then it was like, if I paid $5 for this jewelry and can get $15 for it, that sounded fair. But, you know, it taught you that people would haggle with you and said, listen, I'll give you $12. And as long as you knew your margin, you knew you made money. And it was easier because, you know, you didn't have to pay for your flights to New Mexico. So, you know, we really didn't know everything, but we knew that if it was $5 that we bought it and sold it for $6, we made a dollar in profit. I think those types of things and how you learn math kind of frame you. Today with internet scale and, you know, math is kind of just kind of fallen by the wayside, you know, and the way the world works and everybody wanting scale is it's how much pain and investor dollars are you willing to burn to get you to that where I make a $5 good and sell it for $10. You know, the internet has taught people that you can buy something for $5, sell it for zero. But if you raise enough money, you know, you can eventually charge $100 because no one's left in business. And we're seeing that with like Uber. We're seeing that now with Waymo, where they come in and they can subsidize stuff at internet scale and kind of co-opt a market and raise prices later. So I think the world was a simpler place. You know, I don't long for that old world, but the way young people were taught business are very different than the way.
But isn't it the building blocks theory where you need to understand the basic arithmetic to understand multiplication and then division, then you get into the next level of, you know, statistical analysis and then understand. But if you don't have the building blocks, this is a serious question because I really struggle with this. If you don't have the building blocks for whatever the particular area of expertise that you're trying to build on, how do you actually move ahead of where we are at that point? In other words, if I'm just asking ChatGPT for the equation result, do I even understand what the point of the equation was to begin with?
I think if you can speak English, it comes down to trust. If, and I don't trust much, I mean, I trusted a calculator, I trusted my own math, I've never trusted an Excel spreadsheet because because it's only as good as the person inputting the numbers. The math could work, but it's only as good as the one person in charge of inputting the revenue number, or it's only in charge of the one person who's controlling the expenses. So when I look at an Excel spreadsheet as an investor, I'm like, I assume, just like when I look at the stock market, I assume it's rigged. So again, it's what you're comfortable with. The reason I'm a seed investor and the reason why I'm a momentum investor is part of the reasons I don't believe people understand math. And it's not that I'm like mad about that. It's just that I wouldn't be comfortable investing off spreadsheets because the way I think is people haven't been putting truthful numbers into the spreadsheets. And so you have to learn. And that wasn't a problem. And, you know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s. There was no Excel. Right. There was like, you had to do everything by paper. Ran a public company, my dad who ran a public company, they were like taping pieces of paper together and doing columns work with pencils and a calculator.
Remember those green pads with the columns and the...
Absolutely. I mean, the CFO had a office full of paper just taped together to do financials.
Right.
And then Excel came along, right? So I think Excel is probably one of the greatest, you know, good and bad. Lotus 1-2-3. So think about the Excel world. Imagine doing a corporate acquisition in a world of before Excel.
Can't even imagine.
Right?
Yeah.
Can't even imagine.
Yeah.
Like, so I just happen to be 60 and have all these experiences of like pre-Excel world, which is basically Abacus or, you know, then you had the HP 12, which I never understood. That was a different language. Then you had Excel. And now what I say, we live in a post-spreadsheet era, right?
Right.
Because it's just too much grifting and crime. The spreadsheet means nothing in a world of scale. It means nothing in a world where, you know, the president is willing to cheat. It means nothing in a world where, venture capitalists will invest money in a negative gross margin business because they have enough money to win a market and worry about raising prices later. These are all different games. These are all just different games. But in the end, why the stock market works, full circle here, is because in the end, over a certain amount of time, the game is still about profits and growth. And, you know, you can fool the market for 6 months, a year, 2 years, but over time, and I think Warren Buffett still proves that with his returns, is, you know, the math matters. The actual math matters. People eventually do the math, right? And that's why the markets are fascinating. People will eventually do the math. They're not so efficient day to day or week to week or month to month, but over time they get radically efficient because the incentives change for someone to do the math. Eventually it pays for someone to do the math.
Yeah, and you know, people can hate the market, you know, the market itself day to day, minute by minute, right? Oh my God, this is, or weekly, this is irrational. It makes no sense. Look at oil prices at, you know, above 90 something and this and that, and the world's still going on and Strait of Hormuz and whatever, plug in whatever particular issue is going on at the time into that sentence and then say, well, it makes no sense that this is doing that or this, but you're right. It's long-term. It is appropriately valued, and it still is one of the best mechanisms for creating wealth there is, right?
It's the best. Listen, all my real wealth has come from a few bets in the private markets or starting my own business, right? So I would say the future wealth, like Warren Buffett made, 90% of his money after he was 60. So someone who just turned 60. Exactly.
Happy birthday,
How
man.
How great is that?
Happy birthday to us.
So my job was to just get here. And luckily, I have enough capital now. I say it's never been a better time to be a 60-year-old person with money. Because, you know, if AI is going to kill this, I had 60 good years. Right. I feel bad for my kids all the time because I don't know what the future holds. But, you know, Warren Buffett, if you really look at compounding and wealth, you know, there's two schools of someone with kids. I want my kids to live and not worry about every nickel and not worry about every tax efficient way to save money.
Sure.
Because eventually you got to live because, you know, enjoying it just when you're 60 or 70 is not life. But at the same time, having money when you're 60 and understanding how Warren Buffett compounded 60 is just the beginning of how the magic of working in the markets. You know, 10% just in an index, once you're 60, once you, you know, by the time you're 80, we're talking about real money.
Let's talk about the original investment. Let's go way back beyond, you know, beyond fast forward a little bit when you were the jewelry mecca of New Mexico. There was something called the GRIP with two P's, the GRIP investment. Let's hear a little bit about that. And what was it? Well, I mean, so everybody can hear about it. So, let's talk about how this all occurred, because it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, the GRIP was a cold call. I think, you know, as my son now cold calls for his first job, as much as things change, many things are the same, right? You know, you know, I'm 6 years old and I still make cold calls, right? It's just, you know, different ways of like finding leads, but cold calls. So back in when I graduated with a business degree, an MBA, I, you know, like anybody else, you know, found a job in a newspaper. I was a stockbroker because I needed to live in the United States, and that was the only job I could get that would sponsor me. And I would cold call entrepreneurs, and I would, you know, you had a phone book, which was terrifying, or you could kind of get the local newspaper in Arizona, and there's the Arizona Business Journal. And every week they would list like successful companies, you know, 1 through 20 in different categories, and put a phone number of the founder. And, you know, I would just cold call those founders on the list, seeing if they had money to invest. And I called this one guy, and he had been lying about his success, obviously, to get into the journal. So when I called him, Mark Scatterday, who was the founder of The GRIP, I was excited. He answered the phone, and he said, come, you know, come down. So I thought I had a hot one on the line that had money and was going to invest with me. And when I went down to meet him at his manufacturing facility, he hit me up for money. Right? Oh. And I was just like, I was just a 26-year-old. Anyways, I fell in love with his product, which was called The GRIP. And it was a stress ball made of wrapped latex around birdseed. And when I saw the product, he was selling them in these jars to fitness gyms. I said, why don't you put the name of the fitness, you know, instead of like having these jars with your name on it, why don't you put the name of the gym on this jug, and so that they can give it away to their customers. And that started what became like a, you know, $100 million revenue business in the 90s called The GRIP. But most of our business were putting corporate logos, whether it was Bed Bath & Beyond or Pfizer or Compaq. So this ad specialty business that was this huge business, putting corporate logos on that stuff. We had kind of come up with the pet rock at the right place at the right time for that industry, and just kind of got lucky, rode a wave. The great thing about that industry was, if you make 2 million grips and sell them to Target or Walmart, they may return 1 million of them. Right. And then they may never pay you. They could go out of business. But if you make 250,000 balls for Pfizer, they paid you before you shipped them. So not only did we find a business, we found a business with like incredible margins and no receivables. So it's just one of those rare, you know, businesses that was magical and was rather silly. From that success, though, obviously we made tons of mistakes because we thought we were geniuses. You know, we misinterpreted the genius of this one product and all the markets that it brought to us for our own genius in like discovering products and marketing them. So of course it led to many failed, you know, product launches of other products. But the lesson of The GRIP was, if you have a great product that has great margins, you're on to something, right? Now there's all kinds of things that can go wrong around the way. And I think obviously this is why technology and software have been such great businesses, because you have the ability to sell a product that people love with incredibly high 90% gross margins. So it leaves a lot of room to make mistakes and to still build a good business. So that was the genius of technology, right? Instead of making a product and having to find customers very expensively, you could use the internet to find customers, and software had just higher margins. So of course, the markets have been incredible for the last 20 years because of margins.
Yeah. So fast forward to the last Howard Lindzen insight. Tell me about Yuk Yuks. You there? Did I lose you?
Yeah. No, I'm here.
Oh, yeah. So it's asking about Yuk Yuks.
Yeah. So Yuk Yuks is a comedy club like the Canadian version of the improv. And growing up in Canada, in Toronto, and, you know, I was born in 65. So by the time I was like 12 in 1977, you know, there was a Second City television. And I guess I was just a geek, you know, I was a TV geek. You know, my parents were wealthy, I had a TV, and I would stay up late at night and watch Johnny Carson. And, you know, just like someone today would be, you know, on YouTube and find their passion, whether it's music or golf or whatever their niche thing that YouTube could serve them. You know, when you're 12 in 1977, you had 12 channels or five channels on your television, and you know, you were self-selected into something. Yeah. So back then, you know, TV was entertainment with the likes of Johnny Carson. I was just like fascinated, or smoking cigarettes and they were goofing off and drinking. And, you know, these adults were like, you know, just living the life. And, you know, Johnny used to have comedians on all the time. And so that's what I thought was cool, right? You know, I was just like an awkward kid. And, you know, and Toronto just happened to be the hotbed for whatever reason. Canada still continues to be a hotbed of comedians. And so I grew up around where the water was all comedians. Jim Carrey, Mike Myers, Second City Television. We didn't even need Saturday Night Live because Eugene Levy, these people were hysterical. Yeah. And so Yuck Yucks was this chain of clubs. And Jim Carrey was probably my age, maybe a little bit older. They would be performing at 14 years of age. And, you know, they let young kids in. If you were a fan of that type of stuff, you could go to the clubs. Obviously, you couldn't drink. And you would follow these comedians around because there's no, you know, there's nothing to do. There was hockey and comedy. And so eventually I got up the nerve to, you know, do open mic nights and started doing that for a little while. And that was, you know, my Yuck Yuck story. And it's really shaped kind of some of my investing and, you know, some of my, what interests me on the internet around media. Well,
that's when we first met with Wall Street. That was a yeah, definite branch from this.
Yeah. In the end, I finally got to, the internet allowed me to create something that inspired me from when I was young, right? I wanted to create the Second City version of CNBC on YouTube. So when YouTube came out, you know, this is disgruntled, you know, I didn't have my life's work. And, you know, I was a hedge fund guy and I couldn't beat the market. I didn't know what I was doing. And when YouTube came out, I said, you know what? I'm just going to make like Second City meet CNBC. And we started the show called Wall Strip, and it was really, you know, low budget, you know, and we would
great production, by the way, for low budget.
Great production. 2006, the internet was really just getting started. And CBS, you know, within 6 months, CBS, you know, even though I had no experience on production or comedy or whatever, it was good enough that CBS bought our show. So my claim to fame is we were the first YouTube show acquired by a major media network. Love it. So I went from like clueless to CBS employee. So that became kind of internet famous from that. And just so you know, internet famous back then was if 2,000 people saw your YouTube video.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You were like viral.
Well, that's because it was 4,000 eyeballs.
Right. So, and the eyeballs at the beginning were executives from major media networks who were like trying to figure out
what is this
going to be disruptive.
What is this?
So even though we didn't have big traffic, the eyeballs mattered. So yeah, it was another lesson. It's not how many see you or watch you. It's who sees you or watches you. So influence is something that's always fascinated me, not scale. And I think, you know, it's much sexier to have scale, but in the end, who am I really impressed by? It's Larry David, right? He wasn't an overnight success. He never really had scale until maybe the very end. And he was, you know, this misfit, authentic, weird, comedic genius. And it took 50 years of work for him to become an overnight success.
Yeah.
And so I'm still that guy. Yeah, even though
there's a theme going on here. The theme I keep hearing is we still got a chance.
Exactly. We're the misfits. I think you put in the reps, whether it's weightlifting or golf or whatever it is you do, investing and dollar cost averaging, the reps matter. There's very few overnight successes. And if you're upset by overnight successes, I mean, it's really a distraction, right? There's some people that just get lucky, but yeah. Overall, it's a 50-year grind to build the expertise that eventually leads to money. And we live in an era where a lot of young people have gone rich. That didn't used to be a thing, right? Where 20-year-olds could be billionaires yeah. and 30-year-olds could be billionaires, you know? So it used to be not a thing. And so I think the way media is constructed and the way people choose their mentorships has been kind of screwed up, because it's like the Facebook. It's like the Facebook movie. People think they can be the next Mark Zuckerberg. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but what are the odds? Like, really, that's just, it's that's fantasy.
Lottery ticket. You know, by the way, thinking about The Tonight Show and your avid watcher of Johnny Carson, do you remember a guy named Will Schreiner? The comedian Will Schreiner?
I know the name.
He was a center in Hollywood Squares for a while. He had a thing called, he's a good friend of mine. This guy is, there is never a moment that he's not trying to just comedically rip me apart somehow. Like he's on stage and I'm the guy in the front row, you know?
I was never that good. That was the thing. Now I'm back full circle doing comedy. I've done a few shows myself. My daughter has come to see me, but I'm not like interested in doing it, but I'm fascinated. We're investors in a company called PunchUp.live.
Yes. Oh yeah.
We might have talked about it in one of the episodes, which is really fast growing. So every good comedian uses it, from Sam Morrell to Mark Norman to every good comedian. These are two guys that I really am friendly with now and think they're geniuses. So it's fun I'd be 6 years old and kind of get to hang out occasionally with comedians as a fan, not too stalkery, but like as a fan. But these comedians are like fascinating people. It's not an easy lifestyle.
Kind of like
traders. They work every day. They have a routine. It's scary to break away from the routine. Like us traders having a strategy, you got to stick to your strategy if you want to trade and do this. So I'm really fascinated by that whole industry. And comedians right now are back in vogue because YouTube, because of Instagram, because of TikTok, and because, you know, in real life, people are starting to go back out to comedy clubs. So comedians are really a very interesting, much like traders, right? Like they're very interesting people.
Yeah.
They're not interested in money. They're not interested in the markets. Right. They're interested in the art of it, but they got to go out every night and do work. They work every day.
So I want to just tag on something. You talked about how, you know, who are your mentors or who are you following and what are you looking for? You are involved in the private markets. We know that. You've talked about following the great white sharks like Andreessen. I'll say Horowitz, that's me, but the other Horowitz, some people know him a little bit more. Fred Wilson. So yeah. The average person doesn't have that. They don't know what to do, right? So I know that's one of the reasons you actually built StockTwits. But the question I have is, I guess, you know, we could talk about StockTwits too, but how would the average person follow this? I mean, is it now the way to go into some of these private ETFs or maybe even social leverage, which you could talk about as well? What's the play for the average dude?
It's the ultimate question. So I don't want to, there's no one way. It's like DNA, right? Everybody, it comes down to like a risk score. Everybody has a risk score, and it's something that I'm trying to build a product that kind of caters to this. Meaning, you know, we've been out there. People wear a Whoop, they have their Apple Watch, they have a mattress, they got a score for everything right now.
Yep.
And what's fascinating about it is I don't believe in any of that stuff, man. If you want a good night's sleep and you don't have body problems, just don't drink, don't eat sugar, stop eating at 7 o'clock at night. Do you really need a Whoop? You're not a professional athlete.
I play pickleball regularly. There are two guys that I play with that literally cannot start the game until they push some button. I guess it's pickleball mode on their watch. I'm like, what is this going to tell you?
Nothing. So I'm not a data geek. So that you got to know who you are. So first of all, you know, and so you do have to find mentors. It's both never been easier to find a mentor because you have social networks, but it's also never been more confusing time because people are busy. People aren't looking to give mentorship, right? There's unfortunately been this whole negative theory around if someone's going to teach you how to invest, if they were good, they wouldn't have to charge you. So there's this whole fallacy around, you know, oh, if a guy charges you to help you learn how to invest, he must not be good at investing. And I'm like, that makes no sense to me. Some people are just good teachers. They may just not be good investors, right?
Yeah.
And so I say, don't be afraid of paying someone, right? They have coaches for everything. You got weight loss thing, you got your Whoop. The most important thing is your money and your health, right? So if you have your health, right, do whatever you can do to kind of, you know, not smoke, you know, eat correctly, have as few vices as possible. But next to that is wealth. So if you need to pay someone to truly help you find a strategy that fits your mental, you know, risk profile, all the best. And the sooner you do that and the sooner you stay true to that, the better. And so there's so many ways to do it, right? If I'm the guy that people like, and, you know, I have my own strategy, which is pretty much high momentum, you know, low fundamentals, then it's easy to follow along. But you really want to try and find people that kind of fit your risk profile. And then the other most important thing for someone starting to invest is just to start, right? And there's no shame in indexing. I think indexing still works for 99% of people. I think it's fun to pick stocks. I think the public markets are one of the greatest things ever. But I'm also a major indexer, right? I do direct indexing, which is more tax efficient. But I, you know, 80 to 90% of my money in the market is indexed, right? Because I don't want to time the market. I want to be in the market. Mm-hmm. Now, if we get to a point in the United States where, you know, profits don't matter overall, right? And they do still, like, why would NVIDIA be the, you know, the biggest company in the world? Because their profits are massive and the growth is massive. So that game still works. If they change the rules there, I don't know. But until they change those rules, I think 90 to 99% of investors should just be in the market. And the younger you are, the better. And you don't need mentorship for that. You can open up a Robinhood account or a Freck account or a Wealthfront account. There's thousands of ways to just be in the market. So the sooner you start, the better. The less fancy you are at the beginning, the better. And then understand that what the markets have done historically, right? Companies' earnings, you know, even in the tech era, the S&P or the QQQ has grown 10 to 12% a year with 20% drawdown. So just be prepared. If you invest 10 grand, you know, you should expect, you know, having 11 to 12 grand at the end of the year, but there's a chance during the year that your portfolio could drop to 8 grand.
And by the way, to be clear, that year is not like January 1st, December 31st. You're talking conceptually over a period.
Yeah. It's just math. You ask about math again. This is just math. Like there's no get rich quick. And kids have never really wanted to get rich quick more. Why? Because prices are high. Like they have all kinds of other anxieties that you and I didn't have. So, you know, something that I coined called the degenerate economy is we have an economy of young people who feel like they'll never be able to buy a home. They'll never be able to pay off their school debt. We've saddled these kids with an anxiety that we're not willing to just call what it is, right? Call a spade a spade. We've handed our kids a shit pile of problems surrounding money. Sure, they're going to live two things. They're going to live longer, but they're miserable because they can't afford anything.
You know,
so they're living in the moment. They're thinking differently. They're not the Schwab generation. They're spending, which is kind of cool. They're living their life.
Yeah.
But they're also unfortunately staring at their phones and not really in the moment. So we're in this weird kid. We're in this weird era for kids between, you know, 20 and 35 where the phone just fucked up their lives. And COVID and other things. But it doesn't change the fact that young people should invest and learn how to invest. And there's really no excuse for not indexing and just getting started.
Indexing and working around. So a lot of people think they have to be really fancy. You know this. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. You know, people need to be really fancy. And they need to be the, you know, they have to have the greatest name out there and all that. The fact of the matter is that you can do that. How many times, if you're not working at this on a full-time basis, are you going to be able to track and figure it all out? That's the point. Baseline investing, we can call it, indexing, whatever you want to call it, right? With satellites, right? With you want to have some stocks in there. Okay, there's no go. Have a good time. It's great, you know. Do that, but if you're going to rely on you doing it, you're probably going to get burnt out if you're not doing it full time. You're going to have disappointments where you're going to be like freaked out, and you're going to start pulling out the wrong time because stocks have more volatility. And I think Howard, I think you would agree with me that for everybody listening out there, this idea of you know, look at all the bad things that are happening. There's always bad things happening. Some are worse bad. Some are not so worse. There's always something we could find if we wanted to. And as an excuse to not invest. But I always talk about something. I want to share this with you. I don't think I've talked to you about this. I've talked about what will the future you say about the present you, about your investment habits now, what you did. Because in 20 years from now, I'm certain if you don't invest because of all these different reasons, you're going to be pissed off at the current present you and how you screwed up your future.
Oh, 100%. Right now, I'm more about teaching my kids these basic math problems. My daughter's very into it. My son is like, "You're doing a good job, Dad. I don't want to learn." So they're very different, like everybody's kids, right? My daughter likes to do everything by herself and experiment and doesn't want any help from me, whether it's a job or whether it's, you know, her money, independence. Whereas my son, he won't even get off Morgan Stanley. So I see how he's spending all his money on vaping and food and fast food. He's not ashamed. He's like, he grew up in a world where like he's not hiding anything.
Yeah.
Right. They reveal, they're not ashamed, not because he should be ashamed, but like, big deal. You saw what I ate, you know, big deal. You know, you saw that I'm in an Uber. I think it's a big deal because I'm trying to tell him, like, dude, like, I don't want to see this stuff. So everybody's DNA around this sharing and pride and stuff is different. For my kids, I know one thing as a parent, right? And I'm not telling other parents what to do. I know the problem. I see the anxiety that my kids have. And let me give you the math. When I bought my first home in Arcadia, it was 1996.
Arcadia was where?
That 30 in Phoenix.
Okay, it's a nice neighborhood. This is Arcadia, Florida, and I know you don't like Florida, by the way.
Right. No, I love Florida. So Arcadia, I love Florida. Arcadia, Phoenix, right?
Yep.
And it's a nice neighborhood. Okay, so our first home was $149,000. Right. And it was like a step, like, fuck. But that home was, interest rates were probably the same, 6.5% in 1996, but they were coming down from like 20% from 10 years earlier.
Sure.
So we were like, lock that bitch in. So we put down 20 grand and borrowed what, $130,000 at 6%. Let's do the math. So we were paying, I don't know, $800 a month with insurance to own our home in a great neighborhood. That same home today is $2 million.
Yeah.
Right? We put some work into it. That same home today is $2 million. We moved in, you know. But let's just do this 30-year basic story, okay? That home today in a good neighborhood, and it was always a good neighborhood, is $2 million. That $2 million home, I the same age person that would try and buy that home would have to put down $600,000 right, instead of my $20,000, uh-huh, and still have $1.4 million loan with the same interest rate. The math will, this goes back to math. If you think things aren't broken, understand the kids are not stupid. They can do math. Even a hallucination from ChatGPT would say, you're fucked. It wouldn't give you the number. It would just say,
yeah,
go party in Cabo and rent, right? So when you've taken away choices, and the choices that we had are different than the choices young people had. So we have to recognize that we fucked this generation. Yeah, they may get the money when we finally die, but they're going to get the money much older because we're going to live till we're 80
before we get
their money.
Right.
So it's like all these bullshit excuses of why kids have it better. Listen, I get it. Like they have it better, right? They're going to live longer, but they don't, just because we think that doesn't mean, so these kids are riddled with anxiety and stress, not from the same stress that you and I had or the war generation had, but it's a different type of stress because they know prices and they know they can never afford them. And they don't want to have to take money from their parents. We didn't have to take as much money from our parents. We had independence at an early age. So the markets have pushed independence.
I was 18, by the way, and that was it. Done. No more money.
Yeah, I was done. I left home when I was 17.
Yeah, exactly.
And you got a credit card and you
had a Sears credit card. My father said, you have to get a Sears credit card. Why do I need that, Dad? Because that's how you build credit with a Sears credit card.
That's how you build credit. Now kids have debit cards and Venmo and they can survive. So they're not. Right. Learning the stress of paying the man back. So we have to figure out, it's up to the parent now to somehow coach their kids that it's not their fault. You know, be a good kid, but, you know, we understand your stress. You'll never be able to afford this home, but we're going to help you. Like, don't be ashamed. Like, I don't know how else the game's going to work. So I think parents have to be realistic about the fact that even though kids act like they're 40 when they're 10, because they are. They have a magic wand in their hand. They can fucking go DoorDash. They can Uber. They can they can have a gig economy life. When they're 25, even though they thought they grew up when they're 10, when they're 25, they're going to be back in your home because prices.
And that's a problem.
They're going to be dealing with being ashamed and fight. They don't want to be back at home. It was a better world when they were gone when they were 18 than when they were gone at 10 and back in the house when they're 25. Yeah. So I think these are real fundamental non-investing things that are going on in the economy. And lucky for me, I get to actually work on these things. But I know my kids are going through a lot of stress over this stuff.
A lot of stress.
Yeah. A lot of stress.
Let me I want to tag on two quick items before we go. You do a lot of... I'll call it private, non-public. We'll call it non-public, angels, slash all those kinds of investments that usually have long periods. You know, there's these long periods, 5 to 10 year lockups, maybe, or maybe, you know, we don't know when that event, liquidity event's going to happen, right? These long J curves. With what's going on these days, what you see, what you hear with regard to private equity, private credit, is there any concern that you have with the retail investor, which maybe they got a little spooked with this last go around, being allowed to potentially get this in their 401ks?
Yeah, I mean, this is very personal opinions because, again, I assume most people are going to be bag holders of private companies. I try to be honest about this. And again, it's hard. I'd like to have an ego about my success. But if you're born at the right time and a wave appears at the right time, and you happen to be involved in that wave, there's too many people that think it's because of their own genius. This is my era of young people, of people, my contemporaries, who I fight with all the time online. I'm like, you're confusing a bull market with brand. There's an old saying, and there's never been more people in history that are confusing a bull market with brains. And I'm not saying I don't have ego.
I understand. I get it.
I cannot believe the amount of charlatans that worked at Facebook or LinkedIn or Google. Again, there's 30, 40, 50% of them are mad geniuses, but the other 50% that were along for the ride and are mistaking the fact that they worked at the right company for being wealthy. And so I think people have to be extremely careful of that. And I think AI... Again, Web 2 was very good to me because the internet was very open for a period of 5 to 10 years. And like you could grow without paying for growth. But now growth has never been more expensive. And so when growth is expensive, and by growth being expensive, I mean it's hard to find a new user because everybody's locked down their graphs. It's hard to do marketing because it's expensive and you can't get scale. It's expensive to borrow money. It's expensive to hire an engineer. So it's never been more expensive to grow a business, but it's also never been more inexpensive to start a business.
And, so we're in this weird and easy, right? It's easy.
Easy and inexpensive to start, right. But never been more expensive to be successful.
Right.
And so I am bearish on that. Not bearish on the world. I'm just bearish on private investing when the cost of getting new customers is expensive. So I'd rather be in the public markets because I have liquidity, right? So it's not that I'm not making seed investments. It's just I'm very much more cynical about prices and expertise because, yes, I'm going to be in a company for 10 years, maybe 15 now because it's much harder to grow. And valuations are much higher. So the math isn't as good for me. So I'd rather make less money for the assured liquidity. Now, that part of that could be my age and et cetera, but I am very cynical of what's happening in the private market.
Well, I think a lot of it also is, Howard, we'd have to admit that the private markets used to be like, hey, we found something, it's interesting, it may or may not work, and here's a price for it. Now it's like the same exact backtrack, but here's the price times 1,000, you know, because everybody...
Well, here's the price times 1,000, yeah. And because of AI, 100 copycats of your product could be done
immediately
in a minute.
Right.
So, like with The Grip, my old first company, we had knockoffs, right? It was a squeeze ball with balloons, but our distribution was great. But today, not only is your product going to be knocked off, if you don't understand distribution, the 10th guy to your product could be the winner.
Yeah, and I heard a guy.
There's all kinds of risk of thinking that you're successful and then immediately being wiped out, which is a really, I think that's my problem with this market is I think there's a lot of confident people that are working on an old playbook.
Yeah.
And I think that's a problem. So I'd rather be in the public markets where if I change my mind, I can get out. I don't want to be locked up for 10 years with people that don't know what they're doing. I don't want to be locked up for a long period of time with people that are stupid.
There's a guy I know who sells stuff on Amazon. And what he does is he goes finds the most successful stuff that's selling and he goes grab that product, repackages it, and then just finds ways to maybe either knock the price down a little bit or package it nicer, and he becomes the leader in it. That's what you're talking about. And it happens fast.
It happens very fast. So everybody thinks being arbed away very fast. And so I think just private market, you know, I've changed how I think about private markets. It doesn't mean Andreessen's still not amazing, but they're playing a different game than me.
Yeah.
They're playing with money that doesn't really care about the best return. They're managing billions and billions of dollars and their incentives are very different than mine. Mark Andreessen can go 10 years without a winner. People will still give him money.
Right.
If I went 5 years without a winner, no one would give me money.
Right.
And so I think a lot of people are thinking they're Andreessen and there's only one Mark Andreessen.
Right.
And so he's the unicorn. The company isn't the unicorn. Mark is the unicorn. Fred Wilson is the unicorn. And so I can't afford to invest with Mark Andreessen because he's going to be wrong more than ever. But he can afford to be wrong more than ever. I can't afford to be wrong as often as he is anymore.
Yeah. Let's just finish up on this because I think you have some definitive opinion on this particular topic. And the topic is, what do we do with the official messaging that's coming out of leadership on all sorts of platforms that is coming out fast and furious? Are we to believe? How are we dealing with this?
Well, I feel, again, for my kids, like, I don't know what they're reading, but I know that I'm anxious because I don't trust the Iranians. I definitely don't trust Hamas. I definitely don't trust the UN. I definitely don't trust the New York Times or BBC, but I also definitely don't trust the leadership of the Democratic Party. I definitely don't trust Trump or Vance, and I definitely don't trust the IGRC. So what do we have? All we have left are prices. So really, I've had to you basically have to ignore the news and understand which prices to look at that will give you a much clearer semblance of truth. So what's the biggest issue today? The Strait of Hormuz, whether we like it or not, that's what everybody's focused on. But do I want to read headlines? Is it open? Is it closed? No. So I'm watching oil futures or I'm watching the USO stream on StockTwits because that's the closest thing I'm going to get to the truth. If oil drops below $80 a barrel, I assume the Strait of Hormuz is open. But as long as it stays above, you know, the $90 range or $80 range right now, everybody's lying.
Right. Right. Right?
And I don't need to know day to day. I'll check when oil gets back below 80.
Yeah, give me a call.
I don't know what all that means.
Yeah.
I just know that the Hormuz is open.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, everybody's lying. And I hate this, but it's also easier to live right now because I know they're all lying. They're all assuming both sides are treating, IGRC is treating Iranians like non-humans. And Trump doesn't care about the people that voted for him. He says it out loud. He says, you voted for me, fuck you. That's not even the people he hates. He hates his own voters right now. So we're both countries are being held hostage by their governments. And in America, much better than being an Iranian, no doubt. So when you're held hostage by leadership that's lying, the only thing you can do is check prices. And so I'm trying to just keep my sanity by not going online and just looking at prices and trying to decipher what this war will end. To me, it seems like this is going to be a long war because it's not a typical war. And, you know, we're dealing with two governments that are both insane.
Yeah.
And we're also dealing with two governments. They may say they like their people, but they don't like their people.
Yeah,
we're just being pawns. We're being pawns sure. in some bigger game.
I think what Howard's saying is channeling a good friend of both of ours, by the way, Brian Shannon, only price pays.
Yeah, I've long believed that, meaning it's you have to understand prices move a lot and things can change, but that's where money management comes in. But at least with price, you can have a basis of understanding
sure.
and contextual understanding of what the world looks like. It's not obviously perfectly accurate, but it's one of the smallest data points and one of the largest data points. The price of Google or the SPY at any one time is just a small data point, but it's also accumulation of so much data. So it's both the smallest data point and the largest data point. And that's, to me, comforting. It's not necessarily accurate second to second, because it's constantly moving, but it gives you context for how people are feeling and how confident people are. And, you know, I don't think there's a fast way to learn all this, but in a world where it's easier to make fake news than real news, it's easier to disseminate, you know, fake news. Therefore, it's easy to do it. Why would I go swim in an ocean of fake news?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, as dumb as it sounds, the less news you consume and the more you understand how prices are working, the more you'll understand how people are really thinking, the people that matter. And then the most important thing is the economy is not the stock market. So I'm only giving you the stock market view of how I do things. The economy is a mess. Any way you slice it, the economy is a mess, right? It's great for certain companies, but go look at Nike, go look at retailers, go look at healthcare, go look at education. It's a fucking disaster.
Yep.
So the economy is different than the stock market. I have no understanding of the economy. Zero. But that doesn't mean I can't be a great investor.
Yeah, I hear you.
And so that's how I see the world.
Yeah. Howard Lindzen, all the way from the grip to yuck yucks and forthright into private transactions, of course, creator of many things, serial entrepreneur. Great having you always. And I appreciate great insights today.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Right, see you. See you, Andrew.
All right, buddy.
See,
Howard doesn't hold back, not even for a second. I mean, he's got a lot to talk about and a very, very strong opinion, so that's pretty awesome. Anyway, thanks for joining me this week. Next week, like I mentioned, coming up, we have Meb Faber coming up, and he's going to talk hopefully about what's going on with the emerging markets, ex-U.S. investments in equities, and why they are beneficial, something that he really does a lot of work on and a lot of research, and it's paying off big time right now. Thanks for joining me again. I'll see you again next week. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.